they couldn't get it done. I didn't find a dash three. Thank you. Whoever can go first. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. This isn't a PERS bill, but I guess I'm here to kind of explain the bill, and we've got a handout here for it as well. The topic of this bill are employer side accounts. Employer side accounts are set up when an employer makes a lump sum payment to PERS, basically pays their contributions in advance, usually by issuing a pension obligation bond. And as of December 31st, 2008, we had 142 employers with side accounts out of some 870 or so. A large number of school districts, 96 school districts, and I'm not sure what the total number of school districts is, but the vast majority of the side accounts were established by school districts. State of Oregon, of course, has got one as well with a $2 billion bond that it had issued. We had real success between 2003 and 2007, a five-year period, with our investments averaged over 15%. When these side accounts were set up, they were established to amortize off over a period, and we were assuming we were earning 8%. When we earn more than 8, earn 15, all of a sudden the money available in those side accounts far exceeded what people expected to be in there, and it became of note to the school districts, if you will. Of course, things changed in 2008. And with about a 26%, 27% loss, most of those side accounts now are back down close to where they were originally projected to be on that amortization schedule. There is a possibility that there may be a few employers, one or two, that are still ahead of the schedule, but most of them are back. But we're believers that 2008 is not the dictator of the future, and there's a possibility that we could get back into a surplus situation again, and that's what I believe triggered this bill, that if we got back into a surplus situation, employers could use this money in these side accounts both to offset their PERS employer contribution as well as their individual account program member contribution, the 6% that goes into the member account. The dash two amendments, dash one, dash two amendments, reflects some of the requirements that we asked the proponents to include in this bill, and that was, one, eliminate the refund. Clearly, once money is deposited into the PERS system, it can't be, it's solely there for the benefit of the members, and it can't be refunded out. I think the dash one, dash two amendments reflect that. And we also said this is something that we have to run by the IRS before we implement it. This is a tax-qualified plan, and clearly it's not in anyone's interest to risk that tax qualification, because what that means is we don't have to pay taxes on the money as it goes in. The members pay it on the retirement benefits. So it's in everyone's interest to protect those. And then I believe that there's also been some amendments that have been offered up by the PERS Coalition, the member interest, to try and strengthen these provisions as well, the dash twos and dash threes. One of them requires that there be a vote of the school district board in order to allow this, and the other requires that prohibits the employer from dipping into this side account for anything other than employer contributions whenever they're upside down in this bond. So you can't bet on the come. Not only do you have to get back on the positive side, you actually have to be there when you make this request. So with that, I think I kind of explained the bill. Our big concern was the tax qualification, as well as the refund provisions, and those were taken care of with the dash one, dash two amendments.
So the dash three looks like it is specifically talks about getting a, seeking a ruling from the Internal Revenue Service on whether the applicable excise excess amounts of the account established offset contribution to individual accounts.
Right. I think that was in the dash twos as well. That's shown in addition to the bill. I think, if I remember right, what the dash three added was on line 15 through 18, if the request is made by a school district must attach to the request a copy of the resolution adopted by the board. I'm looking through here, task qualification. I believe that was the main change, yeah. And the others, as long as it doesn't exceed their the liabilities on the bond.
So from the PERS board perspective,
right.
Are all of these okay?
Yes. We don't have any trouble with any of the amendments. Indeed, we ask that some of them be prepared.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions right now, or should we just hear the rest of the panel?
Just let me, if you wouldn't mind, put me on the same page. Are we talking about pension obligation bonds?
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Berger, yes. It's
but now they're called side accounts. Now they're called side accounts.
Deposits when the bond gets issued, the deposits go into what we call a side account.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
I just you know, I feel like I'm walking in the middle of a conversation that I did not start. I just wanted to get on the same page as everybody else. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Either.
Thank you. Chair Roland, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Wilson, and today I'm here on behalf of the Confederation of School Administrators. We think that House Bill 3401 is a simple bill, even though it concerns PERS. Back in 2005, I was the manager of the policy division at PERS, and we worked with our tax attorney to bring to you a bill on behalf of PERS that was Senate Bill 111. And what Senate Bill 111 was a PERS tax qualification. We had just gone through the PERS reform legislation, which, as you know, created two new component programs to the PERS system, and we wanted to make sure that the statute was clear what type of qualified plan the PERS system was. And so we brought forth on behalf of the PERS board Senate Bill 111, and the purpose of Senate Bill 111 was to create a retirement plan and to make sure that without question it was one system with several component parts. But what Senate Bill 111 also did was it would ensure, although without some question, that employers could move their assets from one component part of the system to wherever liabilities may exist in another component part of the system. Senate Bill 111 was eventually absorbed into House Bill 3262, which became the PERS bill for that session. In testimony, PERS stated that if an employer had submitted extra funds to cover liabilities created in PERS Tier 1 or Tier 2, the question was whether or not those assets could be shifted where liabilities existed in other component parts of the system, the OPSERP program. What House Bill 3262 was intended to do was to make it easy or possible for those extra assets of employers that existed in one part of the system to be shifted to liabilities in other parts of the system. We believe that 3401 clarifies what the intent of House Bill 3262 and the legislature intended in 2005, and we're confident that the amendments, the dash three amendments, further provide that clarification. And so I'm happy to answer any questions.
I think we'll let the whole panel go, and then we'll ask a few more.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Kent Hunsaker, Executive Director of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And I'm going to refer you to the multi-page handout that starts to says summary of PERS employer contribution rates. Just kind of a quick study to give you background in terms of school districts, how this works. These are, the first three pages are all of the school districts in the state. They're employer rates for 07-09 and 9-11. You'll notice on the second page there's a line that says it's the line under school districts. That is the rates for 07-09 and 09-11 for all school districts that didn't issue pension obligation bonds.
What line?
Pardon me? they didn't issue pension obligation bonds. So Paul indicated we have 96 districts that did. That means we have about 100 that didn't.
Clarification, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Above the line or below the line? Which are yes and which are no?
Oh, all the other districts are listed in alphabetical order. So this is just the rate for all the school districts that didn't issue pension obligation bonds. All the other districts in here are in alphabetical order, and they're the districts that did issue pension obligation bonds and may eventually fit into this bill.
So that's okay. I'm still not quite clear.
The line is only to so that you'll notice that all there's that line represents 100 and some school districts PERS rates.
Okay.
And I underlined it because I just wanted you to know that 100 districts fit in that category. All the other districts are listed individually.
But the line doesn't indicate any of these are in or not.
No.
Okay.
And in fact, now I'm going to refer you to the yellow pages.
Okay.
Because the yellow pages are...
Mr. Chair, I think there's still some confusion, Mr. Hunsaker. And if I could take a stab at it. Line 3000... which is underlined on page 2, is the rate every school district in the state will pay unless they are separately listed with a unique rate.
That's correct.
Right.
How do you get
And its placement here has no indication as to which school districts do or don't. It just shows the rate.
Right.
It's just also in alphabetical
order. Just all the rates.
Right.
That's
school
correct.
School district comes between Sandy M and CSAC in the alphabet.
And one thing, that as long as we're there, let's just go to the school districts, all right? So if you look at that, their rate, their Tier 1, Tier 2 rate for 07-09, 17.64. You look over to the 09-11 rate, 14.29. That is the amount of savings in Tier 1, Tier 2 rates for all those school districts, okay? In the OPSERP rate, it goes from 19.91 to 14.74.
Yep.
So that is the level of savings in this biennium for districts that didn't bond. All the other districts have their savings on here. I will point out... for example, the Portland School District is a good one to look at. It's on line 3818. Notice that their rate for 07-09 is 0.37%. Everybody find that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you go over to their rate for 9-11, it's 0.29%. So the Portland School District has hardly any savings in their PERS rates. That's one of the reasons this bill is in front of you, because we have a circumstance now where most of the districts in the state have some savings, but we have 33 districts that are building their budgets with no PERS savings. Their rates for 07-09 and 09-11 are very much the same. In this case, 0.08% less. The yellow sheets happen to be the list of those 33 districts. And I've underlined, these lines actually do mean something, okay? Because the districts in that first list from Molalla River up have site accounts that are currently 7 times their liabilities. And I'm going to give you specific testimony about one of those districts in a minute. The ones below that line have site accounts that are currently 6 times their liabilities, their obligation liabilities. And then on the next page, North Clackamas, 5.4 times, their site account is 5.4 times larger than their liabilities. The districts on this list are the districts most likely down the road to utilize this system. So you can see, Portland's very interested in this, as are many of the others, because number one, they have no PERS savings to build their budget, and number two, they have really large site accounts. Is there questions on that piece? If you go to the green sheet now, that is the testimony, the written testimony from the Portland School District. So as you see in this testimony, they have a site account of $786 million. It is $678 million larger than their pension liabilities. And if they use the site account to pay their IAP, you'll notice the $16 million in bold. That's what they would be using of that excess. Now, Portland indicates in here that this valuation was done in December of 2007. So the 2008 earnings are not in here. So if you were to take 27% off of Portland's earnings, it would be $200 and some million that they would lose. Their liabilities also go up. So what Mr. Cleary represented is that gap is going to get much closer. But we believe Portland will still be well above their assets in their site account will still be well above their liabilities. And I just provide that testimony for you because it was written by Portland. I've also provided three evaluations. These are the ones that districts get. Every district that has a site account gets this evaluation. And it is the evaluation as of December 31st of 2007. So the very stuff that Portland just indicated is in this evaluation. Their site account balance, $786 million. Up above is their UAL of $109 million and the difference in parentheses, $678 million. So currently, the Portland School District has $678 million above what their liabilities are, except for what Mr. Cleary represented, and that is they lost 27% of that money in 2008. It's followed by the Gladstone School District.
Yes. Plus their liability would have also increased.
Their liabilities would go up. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And then it's followed by the Gladstone School District, so you can see that theirs is liabilities of $4 million, a site account of $25 million, for a total of $21 million more.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question. Does the OIC invest the site accounts? Does it manage the investment of the site accounts?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, yes, it does, and it's managed as part of the regular account. So it's invested the same as the Tier 1 dollars and the IAP dollars.
Now, it's our belief that over time, it may well be that it's narrowed, but over time, this bill will mean something. If not, when we find out from the IRS and we're able to look at that, this bill will mean that these site accounts that have grown and are likely to grow in the future could be utilized to the extent of the 6% IAP in districts for Portland School District. It'd be 16 for Gladstone School District. I think it's 670,000 or something like that. But it represents savings that they could use over time to assist with their liabilities. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I guess my question is is there any indication here which of the school districts, the 98 or so, have site accounts? Do we know that in this information you gave us?
Chair Roblin, that would be everyone who's listed individually on the rate sheet here in those first three pages. Because if you don't have a site account, you're lumped in with all the other school districts. And maybe as an explanation, again, maybe focusing on Portland, you can see if Portland didn't have a site account, their employer rate would be the same as all the other school districts that don't, 17.64%. If you look on that rate sheet right behind your green sheet that Kent included, that's the principal valuation results for Portland. The row, or it's called calculated site account rate relief, -22.1%. Had the employer rate been 22%, Portland would have been able to take full advantage of the site account. But because it was only 17, that's why their rate got driven down to zero, and everything else just stayed in their site account. It's not like they, at the risk of correcting Kent, but maybe to illuminate a little bit differently, they don't lose the savings. They just can't take advantage of them in this biennium. They are retained in the balance of the account, and they're there going forward. But the reason why these rates vary so much is people had different size site accounts relative to their payroll. If you had a really large site account relative to your payroll, you could drive. We collect all your contribution from the site account amortization, and you wouldn't owe us any new money. But some of the other ones, obviously, you've got like Multnomah, 12.5. They've got a small site account relative to their payroll. And so you'll see that whole variation. The idea here, I think, was there was about, and again, this was based on the 12/31/07 valuation, which has changed. There was about 30 school districts where we'd driven the rates all the way down to zero, and they had some money that they could have used had our rates been higher, or could they have, had they had this bill in place and they could have applied it to the IEP. Now, I just want to make sure everyone understands that, you know, 2008 then happened, and most of those side accounts have been driven down to where you won't see this in the next valuation. And so we've got, there's very few that could take advantage of it in the next two or three years, but the hope is that down the road we'll be back in this situation again.
Oh, not part of it. Representative Girard.
I'm getting back to your green sheet for just a moment.
Yep.
If the side account balance for Portland is approximately $678 million, why in the final paragraph on the green sheet does it say that PPS faces cuts of $33 to $52 million that the side account funds would not fit the budget hole? I don't care who answers.
The unfunded liability is the bill that's going to be paid over about a 20-year period remaining
okay.
on this. It's not all due or all available in 1 year.
Okay, that answers it. Thank you.
And Chair Roblin, Representative Girard, I think that the idea behind this is that even though they have an excess at this time, and the only amount that they could actually pay for would be $16 million a year.
Okay.
So the fact that they have a larger deficit, they couldn't go and access more of this money because this bill only allows them to pick up the IEP. And in Portland, the IEP is $16 million.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you. Could I talk just a little bit about process here? If my understanding, the legislature then allows the PERS board to be the gatekeeper of when they can access this and which districts can. Is that my understanding?
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Berger, under this bill and the amendments, it would be, one, we'd first have to get clearance from the IRS. So it requires
That's
us to get a private letter ruling. And that, you know, our experience with that is that's on IRS time, but we would anticipate it could take at least 6 to 12 months to do that. We also then would have the 2008 valuation completed, and that will really compress the number of entities that could immediately utilize this. And then it looks like there's some requirements. The school district board would have to pass a resolution. We'd have to certify that they're not upside down in their bond, and then there'd be that process going forward.
So that would basically, under the dash three, they're asking for the IRS. Is that what I understand? Or requiring the IRS?
Vice Chair Berger, that actually was in the dash ones as well. I think the dash three incorporates dash one, dash two, and dash three. But that was things that
okay.
we requested on the House side, yeah.
Okay. And so the process would be that IRS would give it the okay.
Right.
Districts then would apply according to their need and where they are after they've got the evaluation of the
new
side account.
Right.
And then the PERS board would review and say, yeah, you have the money, and yeah, you can apply it.
Right.
Okay. I think.
And
I get it. Despite this list that lost me.
Representative Berger, one other thing to throw in there is that every district would be required to do an actuarial study before they looked at that. I think that's an important one, too, so they have a good picture by an outside agency of what this would do.
What their site account really would fund. Okay.
So I want to make sure of a couple things. One, the dash threes incorporate the ones and the twos. Is that everybody's understanding? So if we just do the threes, we've got it all? Okay. Number two, for the committee, my intention is we don't have the paperwork we need for this one. So we are going to just carry it over. And that'll give you some time to look it over and make sure you know. But my intention is that we will move this bill. We probably will move the dash threes today just so we get it ready to go and put it on a work schedule. And then my last question is, so let's say, we've been using Portland. Portland decides that they go through this whole process and they get to use some of this money to offset the $16 million that they have, and they do that 2 or 3 years in a row, and then we have another hit, and all of a sudden the site account isn't big enough to take care of their unfunded liability. Does their liability still exist?
Chair Roblin, yes, it still exists, and this would be a two-year bite at a time because it would be based on our valuations, and so we set contribution rate for a two-year period. The offset would be available for 2 years, and then you'd have to look at it again. I think everyone is interested in ensuring that the proceeds of these bonds are spread out over the original time horizon and not all eaten away in a short time period, so that's all the protections that we build in.
Okay, I appreciate that, because that was the only, when I first saw this bill, it was the only thing that really made me very nervous, is that these districts have gone out and done something proactively to get themselves in better position over this long term.
Right.
And all of a sudden they see these rapid growth, so they decide, well, we need to use it now, as opposed to what it was there for, and some way down the road they've used up the bond that they had really set for taking care of this future obligation, and they're in the same position they were, and they don't have the bond, and they're back to the obligation. So.
Right. Sure. Well, I mean, it's shiny. We just want to make sure it's not fool's gold.
Yeah, that's exactly. Okay. Okay. So any other questions for this panel?
Chair Roblin,
yes.
I would point out in our testimony, we do talk about some fiscal impacts on this. There is a cost for us to get a private letter ruling, and there's also some system modifications that would be required to do it, and I'd be remiss if I didn't point those out to you. So. And we might, you know, the site accounts have special administrative cost. You know, it could be that something under rulemaking with an application fee or something could cover some of these. But I want to make sure people understand there is a fiscal impact on it.
And if that comes back, this bill may end up with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And that's
okay.
The other thing we have to wait for, to make those determinations.
Okay.
So I appreciate that.
Appreciate it.
So currently there was no one else that jumped up to talk about this bill, and knowing the complexity of it, I was certain there had to be other people sitting in this room who wanted to come speak, but seeing no other people, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3401. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3401 for the sole purpose of taking a motion on the amendment. Just to get it there so we
would
can go.
Would you just like the dash threes?
Dash threes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash threes dated 5-18-09 in the House Bill 3401.
Representative Edwards moves the dash three amendments to House Bill, let me get my back, 3401. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. And so House Bill 3401, as amended, we will move forward the work session only to the docket for Wednesday. And hopefully by then we'll have the information we need to make the next decision.
Yeah.
And with that, we're going to close the work session on 3401.
Okay.
And just in case, we had a belief for a while because of some meetings that we were going to not be here at 4 o'clock. We were going to have to adjourn, but that was changed, so we don't have to do that adjournment. But because of that, we had talked to the people who sponsored HJR 13 to give them some notice that they probably weren't going to be heard today. They subsequently redid everything and are expecting to be here on Wednesday, so we're going to move HJR 13 to Wednesday as well, both the hearing and the work session. So just so if anybody was here waiting for that bill, I didn't want you to be surprised that it didn't come up. With that, which one?
2682.
Yep. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2682A. We'll have a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2682A directs the Joint Legislative Interim Committee to study the feasibility of implementing a commercial surety bail bond system in Oregon. Requires the committee to study six specific areas and invites participation from various agencies. This measure has been before this group before. There is a dash six amendment, which I believe the proponent will explain.
And as we get to that, I just want to say we're going to try to do the same thing with this bill that we just did. If we agree to the dash six amendments, we'll put them in and we'll send it because we don't have all the paperwork we need to move it. So with that, Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Gardner, representing Aladdin Bail Bonds, and I've been working on this project with Paul Romaine, who's in the audience, representing the American Bail Coalition, which is a trade association of sureties, insurance companies that work in this area. The A6s are essentially aimed at eliminating the fiscal impact statement, the fiscal impact of the A-engrossed bill, which came in at $100,000 because it was interpreted to require essentially the Interim Judiciary Committee to retain consultants to do the study. The way the bill is rephrased in the A6 amendment, it simply allows the committee to solicit testimony, which we believe, based on our conversations with the staff of the Interim of the Judiciary Committee and others, should entirely eliminate the fiscal. So that's the purpose of the A6s.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2682A, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2682A. Again, this is a bill that our Judiciary Committee recommended that we deal with, but it came here so that it would have no fiscal, because that's their goal and it's an interim study. So we want to help them get to that point, so I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Berger.
I move the A6 amendments to House Bill 2682.
Representative Berger moves the -6 amendments to House Bill 2682A.
I got the A.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. So it is now as amended, and we will carry this bill forward, just the work session part, having had the public hearings, to Wednesday. And we're going to close our work session on House Bill 2682. And do I see Representative Cowan? Perfect timing. So we're going to open a public hearing on HJR 7A because of perfect timing by Representative Cowan.
Oh, these are slow here. My goodness.
So we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Joint Resolution 7A proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to remove the term war as it pertains to the Oregon War Veteran Fund in order to broaden the eligibility pool of veterans. It removes the ineligibility of out-of-service more than 30 years provision to ensure qualified veterans are eligible, removes the state residency requirement for the veteran in the case of not remarried spouses, thereby increasing the number of spouses eligible, includes school or training only as part of active duty training. The Oregon Constitution denies veterans who have been out of service for more than 30 years eligibility for the ORVET home loan program. One of the Governor's Task Force on Veterans Services final report in December of 2008 recommendations is to ensure that the Oregon ORVET home loan program be aligned with the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs lifetime benefit for home loans. House Joint Resolution 7 is a proposed amendment to the Oregon Constitution to change eligibility requirements for the ORVET home loan program. Major modifications include removing the term war, using the term veteran as defined in ORS 488.225 to ensure that more post 9/11 veterans are eligible, the extension of veterans who served a period of active duty, extension to veterans who served a period of active duty under honorable conditions, but not necessarily during war, allowance for the spouse of a qualified veteran, and as I've indicated, excludes active duty schooling under most circumstances. It also requires the passage of companion bill, House Bill 3470, to become effective.
And just so we note, we received, for the record, a letter of support from Representative Holvey, and so hopefully we'll introduce that for the record as well. And I think we also have Mr. Brown want to come up to as well, and we'll start with Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10. And I chair the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee, hence the reason I'm babysitting this bill through your committee, and am here on behalf of Representative Holvey as well, who is currently chairing a committee that doesn't have a quorum until I get back. So I appreciate the explanation of the bill. He asked me to be as quick as possible. But I don't want to rush it to the point that I don't respect the importance of this particular bill. It is extremely important to the veterans community and to the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee that we move forward with the concept that a veteran is a veteran is a veteran, and that we make the home loan availability there for everyone who is eligible. I understand that it will take a constitutional change, and therefore we need to go through that process of referring it out. I believe that this is a measure that will be well received by our public in recognition of the service that veterans have provided and what they what we all believe that they are currently eligible to receive. The implementation required will come in House Bill 3470, as mentioned. That passed the floor of the House, if you recall, on a 59-0 with one excused vote. Very well supported. It's currently moving through the Senate process as we speak. And I think I would just close that in committee we heard testimony from individuals who simply had not taken advantage of the Veterans Home Loan Program, kind of gone through life and figured it would be there and then decided it was time to move into a different home and knew that this loan was available to them only to find that they'd been out 32 years and by Oregon law were not eligible. We think that needs to be corrected. And finally, I would just say that the home loan program is solvent, well-funded, believes that it can certainly accommodate these requests, in fact, that ultimately that will stand to benefit the home loan program. Beyond that, Mr. Chair, all the technical questions can be answered by those who know what they're talking about.
But we have Representative Girard, who would like the opportunity to ask you a question.
Just 30 seconds. Representative Cowan, as a veteran who was discharged way over 32 years ago, thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Representative.
That's it, Mr. Chair. 15 seconds.
Take some more time.
Yeah.
The committee is very respectful of all of you who deserve this.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative.
We have a fairly large fiscal that came back on this bill.
Really?
Which surprises us.
Fiscal that I have in front of me, Mr. Chair, would indicate $38,000 for the voters pamphlet and $5,500 to the election division, basically to go through the process.
Yeah, it is $38,000. I think that's probably livable. We'll have to have that discussion here as we get closer. It doesn't have a subsequent referral. And so we're going to have a discussion that's in that close to range of whether we want to send it or whether we feel comfortable sending it to the floor as a committee.
Send it.
Okay.
Good heaven.
I'm feeling
We've
good.
Already moved out 3470.
There we go. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. If I might be excused.
You are excused.
Thank you.
Well, hopefully we'll take action today so you'll miss that part, but you can read about it later.
Let Representative Colby know. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is actually Tom Mann. I'm the Public Information Manager and Legislative Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I apologize, my director is not here, Jim Willis. He's on a furlough day. My Deputy Director, Paula Brown, whose testimony you have in front of you, is delayed. She is with the Oregon Merchant Marines Association today, those wonderful people who sailed the Atlantic Ocean bringing men and materials to the European theater during World War II. Paul Evans, the Governor's Policy Advisor on Veterans and Military Affairs and the Chair of the Governor's Task Force on Veterans Services, is sick. So you're deep into the bench today, when you get me. But I am well-versed in this bill, having actually drafted it. I want to thank the committee for hearing this. We've been through the Veterans Committee. We've been through the Revenue Committee. We are now in the Rules Committee. This bill does exactly what your administrator says. It has two components. It eliminates the 30-year restriction on the veteran's home loan. That means, to put it in perspective, Vietnam-era veterans could now get the home loan, who are now all aged out under the current constitutional requirements. It also did one other thing. It redefined the eligibility of veteran. And why we did this was, currently in the Constitution, you have to serve 210 consecutive days to be considered eligible for this program. In statute, you're a veteran at 178 consecutive days, and a plethora of other requirements. For example, if you're a service-connected disabled veteran, you're a veteran. If you're receiving pension, you're a veteran. If you have a campaign medal, you're a veteran. But not in the Constitution. So it very much limited who was a veteran in this old constitutional language from 1945. So what we did to this bill through H.R. 7, we said, look, let's just make this a lifetime benefit for veterans, get rid of the 30-year rule, one, and two, let's define veteran as it is in statute, 408-225. That's where House Bill 3470 comes in, which you've already passed. So it's really a simple little measure. We feel that the public will embrace this. And how do we know this? The governor's task force traveled to 24 cities during the interim, held town halls, and in every one of them, the veterans clamored for this to be changed to a lifetime benefit. So we know that there's public support for this within the veteran community, and we don't feel this is at all controversial. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any of the technical questions you have about our loan program or how we think this will play out should this pass in terms of the input we'll get from veterans wanting this loan.
Any questions? The only one I have is just to reassure everyone that the money is there so that all of a sudden they start asking for a loan and they say, oh, sorry, we don't have any money. That would be a little frustrating to me.
Sure, Mr. Chair, let me explain that part. We use what are called qualified veteran mortgage bonds. And the qualified veteran mortgage bond, up until last year, we were limited to $25 million of bonding authority a year. However, last year, Congress changed that, and now we're allowing us $100 million of bonding a year. Last year, for example, we did, $55 million worth of loans. So we were well underneath caps and money, and we felt very comfortable about that. One thing I need to add that's in the testimony from my deputy director, to change this to a lifetime benefit in the Oregon Constitution is one part of a two-pronged policy. The Qualified Veteran Mortgage Bond is a 25-year limited program in the IRS tax code. Congressman Blumenauer has dropped legislation for us. It is H.R. 2319. That has been signed on by with California, Wisconsin, and Texas to eliminate the 25-year rule on the qualified veteran mortgage bond. So if we can do the constitutional amendment in Oregon and get rid of the 30-year rule and do the bill in Congress to get rid of the 25-year rule, we will then have a lifetime benefit.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions of this witness? Again, those are the only people signed up. Is there anyone else here wishing to speak to House Joint Resolution 7A? Seeing no one, we're going to close our public hearing on HJR 7A, and we'll take a motion. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move HJR 7A to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Berger moves HJR 7A to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Girard.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Excused.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards.
Excused.
Chair Roblin.
Aye. Motion passes. I think I will assign Representative Cowan to carry this bill. And we're going to close our work session on HJR 7A. We're going to open a public hearing on HJR 54. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 54 encourages the state of Oregon to support establishment of a statewide network of hospitals capable of performing percutaneous coronary intervention to provide rapid and effective treatment of heart attacks. Quick medical intervention for heart attacks significantly reduces the mortality of those catastrophic events. Time is so critical in reducing mortality that collaboration between many organizations is vital to effective treatment. House Joint Resolution 54 encourages the state of Oregon to support the establishment of a collaborative network of hospitals capable of performing percutaneous coronary intervention, otherwise known as PCI, to provide rapid and effective treatment of certain heart attacks or STEMI. ST, elevation myocardial infarction.
You got it. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
I'm going to let Dr. Brian Gross go first, and then I'll go and followed by the department.
Sounds great.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Brian Gross. I'm a cardiologist, Dr. Gross, from Medford, Oregon for 27 years, and I'd like to thank Representative Maurer and supporters of HJR 54, because it will bring to our hope political encouragement throughout the state to enhance the heart attack care that can be delivered everywhere in the state. It's been said acute heart attack treatment is the most complex, multidisciplinary, and time-sensitive therapeutic intervention in the world of medicine today. The process is measured in minutes. The outcomes are measured in mortality, and teamwork and smooth transitions are absolutely essential. I suspect that there are few in this room who have not been affected directly or indirectly with a colleague, family member, perhaps even themselves, with someone having had a heart attack. It is the most ubiquitous of all major medical illnesses and takes the greatest number of lives in the United States today. Yet heart attacks can be treated probably more effectively than most other medical conditions, and it requires a rigorous sequential facilitated approach from a whole host of different people involved in the healthcare system. In a little bit of perspective, if you go back one generation to the late 1960s and 70s, nearly one out of every four, 250 out of every 1,000 people died of their acute heart attack. And in the late 70s and 80s, that number was down to perhaps 150 out of 1,000. And then throughout the late 80s and 90s, and in many places around the country today, the death rate from an acute ST segment elevation heart attack, that's the big heart attack, is still around 80 to 100 people out of every 1,000 people who have it. We have proven in our neck of the woods and in other areas around the country that you can reduce this death rate to 30 or 40. Out of every 1,000 people. That is an incredible mortality improvement for a medical condition. And it requires the coalition, the facilitated action of a whole host of healthcare providers, from patient recognition to EMS to identify in the field, to hospital emergency rooms, to cardiology teams and cath labs. And what we could say is that if you take a look at the first handout that you have, the picture of the heart catheterization, what we do in a heart attack is here you have the main artery on the front completely blocked right at the beginning,
And then if you can get to it as quickly as you possibly can and get a wire and a balloon and a stent across it, the stent being in the upper left-hand corner and the bottom right-hand corner showing what the heart attack would consist of, you can get that artery open and salvage significant muscle and significant lives. We have been able, through in Southern Oregon, to bring together Jackson and Josephine County and Northern Siskiyou County from California, and we started this process in 2003, and we're amazed at the results that we had, and we've published them. And I would follow with a comment that is, I think, we're rather proud of. In 2007, we went to the American College of Cardiology, which is based in Washington, D.C. Our article was just published, and Dr. Douglas Weaver, who heads the American College of Cardiology, 30,000 international cardiologists, started this conference, which was designed to bring together the greatest minds of cardiology from Harvard and Hopkins and Duke and Mayo. And we were all there, and he opened the conference with the following lines. He says, "We're here today to reproduce in this country what they are doing already in Southern Oregon." And there are other areas in the state and around the country that are doing this. You can take a look at just kind of the continuous process improvement on the second slide. The key to this, paramedics being taught how to read EKGs and activate a system that previously, and in many places, works with great inertia, and they activate the system, and every year we get better and better. And what we've been able to do in Southern Oregon is to bring Josephine County, a more rural community, where the time in the year before we started this program, nearly 240 minutes to get a patient to the cath lab and get the artery open. In the first year and a half was the middle graph, and then you can see it equals what we can do in Jackson County by just having this coordinated system. So we're pleased to have the enthusiasm and support of many of our partners in this, because it is not just the American College of Cardiology, it's the American Heart Association and the Oregon EMS system, Oregon State Ambulance, Oregon Office of Rural Health, the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, and hospitals throughout the state. We're coming together to have a major conference that we can try and coordinate to set the groundwork for this process, so that we could be known as perhaps the best state in the country to have a heart attack in.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Ron Maurer, House District 3. And I don't know if you have it yet, but I have a three-page handout that I copied from the American College of Emergency Physicians National Report Card on the State of Emergency Medicine. And the reason I gave this to you was the question is, well, why is this important? We're not asking for state resources. We're asking for visibility from the legislature, because that's how we can improve programs. And the cardiologist approached me, and I am, of course, very supportive of the program in Southern Oregon. It has made a huge difference for people in Josephine County to survive what were previously unsurvivable traumatic events. If you look at the sheet, it says Oregon does not rate very well in emergency medicine, specifically in the quality and patient safety and environment section. We rate a D+. I will come back to the first page. In the second page, it lists a number of elements, sub-elements of how this rating was arrived at. And there's two things that Oregon could do better at. And one is whether the state has a PCI network or STEMI system of care. Oregon currently does not have one, and we hope to change that eventually. Not necessarily through this body, but we hope to change that. The other area is for patients with acute myocardial infarction, given a PCI within 90 minutes of arrival. Currently, it says we're at 59%, and I think Oregon could do substantially better than that. We can do it in a rural part of the state. I think it could be replicated across the state. And also, the last page shows us how poorly Oregon rates in emergency medicine, and I think that we can, in those two particular areas, help this rating. It doesn't change many things, but we do it one step at a time. And back to the very first page. I've highlighted in yellow where it says funding for an EMS quality improvement program and investing in the development of formal stroke and PCI STEMI systems of care would substantially improve Oregon's quality and patient safety environment. And so we urge your support of this resolution as a show of support for improving the health of Oregonians. And I'll turn it over.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I'm here today because one of the programs in my office is the Emergency Medical Services and Trauma Systems Program. So we're very interested in this issue. Last fall, I had the distinct pleasure of being at an event that was the 20th anniversary of the Oregon Trauma System. And we had about 500 people there. There were people from, of course, all over the state, but there were people from all over the country, and there was even an international contingent as well. The reason I bring this up is that there really are some similarities. The important thing about the trauma system is that you need to get people out to the scene, EMTs, out to the scene as quickly as possible, give them appropriate on-scene care, transport them to the most appropriate facility, which is not necessarily the emergency room that is closest, and then finally make sure that there is appropriate care at that hospital. Oregon, 20 years ago, was one of the leaders in creating trauma systems, and in Oregon as well as across the nation, we have been able to show that there have been substantial decreases in mortality due to the fact that we have this trauma system in place. What's happening now is we're finding out that there are other conditions that also would work very well with similar kinds of systems. And as Dr. Gross pointed out, STEMI heart attacks are one of those conditions that has been proven in other states already that this works. And as you've already heard, we have some pioneers here in the state of Oregon, Dr. Gross in Southern California, and the hospitals and agencies that he's been working with have done remarkable work to do similar things to reduce the time it takes to get a patient with a heart attack to definitive care, and that has led to improved outcomes. So we're also very supportive of this resolution because we think that it's this kind of statement that can help us with our work with a variety of different stakeholders to help move these kind of system development, system improvement projects forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these?
Mr. Chair, one other comment. It's not just Dr. Gross and the cardiologist, like you said, it's the EMS system in the hospitals. And, in fact, when you have organizations that are competing against each other, hospitals, this isn't always a very easy thing to do. But I think most hospitals recognize that, in fact, you need to do it. And the ambulance services are, in fact, more than willing to do it because they enjoy getting involved. That's just what they like to do. In Southern Oregon, we have a great trauma system. And, in fact, we have such a good trauma system that the state of California stole one of our trauma coordinators and is now the trauma system coordinator for the state of California because they did not have one, and they still don't have a very good system. And that just happened last year. Jonathan Jones worked at Three Rivers Community Hospital and was snatched from our jaws in order to help California.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Seeing none. Is there anybody else that would like to testify? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on HJR 54. We're going to open a work session on HJR 54. And with that, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move HJR 54 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves HJR 54 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? I guess what I would say is that last interim, we took a tour, a rural health tour in Southern Oregon, and we went to one of the fire stations out in the hinterlands, that this was the one thing they wanted to talk to us because they were the proudest of this, that they did their EKGs on the spot, that they communicated directly back to the hospitals, and they bypassed the emergency rooms. They took their patients directly to the cardiac the cardiologists that wherever it was supposed to be, and that even those that in the daytime they helicoptered and it worked out really nice, but even when they had to transport at night, their success rate, and they were really pleased, and they represented a lot of area where people camp and there's people from all over that come visit, and they were really pleased that with the interactions between the groups that are working in Southern Oregon. So it was truly a highlight, one of the highlights of our trip. So with that, if there's no further discussion, we'll take a roll call vote on HJR 54.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Robles?
Aye. Motion passes, and Representative, would you care to carry this bill?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. We'll have our representative.
Okay.
So with that, and thank you very much. So we'll close our work session on HJR 54, and we're going to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 577. Since our senator is here, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator, and if you would like to come and take your seat, you can, Senator Metzger. If you have anybody else that would like to bring with you, that'd be fine too.
Well, come on up, because I think they're coming up next.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 577 requires certification of appeals to the Supreme Court for judgments of cases challenging the constitutionality of government ethics provisions of Chapter 8, Oregon Laws 2007. It requires expedited review of such cases by the Supreme Court, declares the next emergency effective upon passage. Senate Bill 10 in 2007 established monetary limits on gifts, entertainment, and honoraria received by public officials from people with legislative or administrative interest. Or S244.025 set a monetary limit on gifts at $50 and prohibits a person with legislative or administrative interest from giving any gifts of entertainment. Or S244.042 prohibits a person from providing honorarium with a value of more than $50 to a public official in connection with the official duties of the public office. In 2007, Van Natta filed a lawsuit, Van Natta versus Oregon Government Ethics Commission, challenging the constitutionality of the limitations imposed on gifts, entertainment, and honorarium. Mr. Van Natta lost in the lower court and is appealing the decision to the Oregon Court of Appeals. Following the legislative reform of the public employee retirement system, PERS, in 2003, multiple lawsuits were filed that challenged the manner in which the PERS system was administered. In order to expedite the resolution of any legal and statutory ambiguity, House Bill 2409, 2003 passed, which allows direct certifications of appeals to the Supreme Court of cases challenging PERS provisions. Senate Bill 577 confers similar jurisdiction authority upon the Supreme Court for cases challenging the provisions of Senate Bill 10 in 2007, as were provided to PERS cases in House Bill 2409.
That's it. And with that, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And I almost wonder, I should sue for plagiarism because Mr. Watson wrote just about, spoke just about everything I had written here. So I will not duplicate what Mr. Watson said. I think he characterized it very well. Let me just say this. Both of our committees, the Senate Committee on Rules, in which I serve, and yours, and dealing with 10 and some of the work that we have done on that, we both have had numerous discussions on the gift limits, et cetera. And what we decided on the Senate side, passing unanimously out of the committee and unanimously on the floor of the Senate, was that this issue is very complex and we really can't deal with it until we have constitutional issues that are decided. And so when the constitutionality of legislative action is challenged in court, as Mr. Watson said, it is the responsibility of this body to act in the public's best interest, expedite judicial review so the appropriate legislative action can be taken to remedy any infringement on free speech or direct us as a legislative body how to best act in the public's interest. This will expedite that. It will save the state some money because we all know it's going to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we believe, as we did in the PERS case, that an expedited review and decision is in the best interest of the public. And with that, I will conclude.
State Supreme Court, right?
The U.S. The State Supreme Court, excuse me, yes.
Just wanted
state.
To make
that. Well, we could do that, too, but we'll just stay with the State Supreme
Court. I think the question we really need to answer is our good old state. But, yes, I agree with you. I agree. Any questions? Or do you have to leave right now? Or are you okay?
I'm in education. Representative Gelser is talking to us, so.
Yes, and we would love her to come back, so she.
Yeah, we'll try to get her back.
Okay,
quickly.
That would be appreciated too. Any questions for Senator Metzger before he leaves? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. DiLorenzo.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. For quite a few years, I have been counsel to the Center to Protect Free Speech, an organization which, along with Fred Vanetta, who is sitting at the back of the room, has a fairly long tradition in challenging campaign finance and other provisions that we have felt violated Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which protects the right to speak freely on any subject whatever. I want to thank Professor Watson for his synopsis. He served as staff on the Oregon Law Commission. I'm a member of the Law Commission. When the commission was taking up the issue of ethics, did a superb job, and I am very pleased to be able to work with him once again. Our first undertaking began, again, quite a few years ago when we challenged Ballot Measure 9 and Ballot Measure 6, which provided for significant campaign finance limits. And the court in Vanetta versus Kiesling decided that campaign finance limitations offend Article 1, Section 8, because the contributions themselves are speech. One of the issues in our Senate Bill 10 case was our lobby expenditures, which are restricted to $50 in any one calendar year, speech. The state took the position that they are not speech, they merely facilitate speech. We took the position that they were themselves speech. The circuit court agreed that the lobby expenditures were themselves speech, but then found that the incompatibility exception, an exception that is created by the courts when a certain type of speech is incompatible with one's office, the circuit court found that the incompatibility exception applied. For the first time, the court extended this exception to legislators. Up until then, the exception only applied to judges. It is normally used, for instance, to uphold rules and laws that prohibit a judge from commenting on a case in the newspaper while the case is pending. To exercise the judge's free speech rights would be incompatible with the judge's functions as a judge. Here, the circuit court found that accepting expenditures in excess of $50 was incompatible with legislative functions. We then came back several months later in our motions for summary judgment, and we changed our tact, and we said, all right, assuming for the sake of argument that that is the case, Senate Bill 10 discriminates among speakers, and that is because it only applies when one has a legislative or administrative interest. And as you know, that is a term of art, which means an economic interest distinct from that of the general public in one or more bills, resolutions, etc. And so if you are a group that has a religious interest in saving the salmon, you could advocate in the legislature a bill that would shut down the salmon sports season. The argument being that maybe the best way to preserve an endangered species is to not kill them to begin with. If you are such a group and have no economic interest whatsoever, a religious interest or a political interest or some other interest, Senate Bill 10 is not applicable to you. If, on the other hand, you are the sports fishing industry or the commercial fishermen, you do have an economic interest in resisting. If you resist, Senate Bill 10 is applicable to you, and if these expenditures are, in fact, speech, then Senate Bill 10 discriminates among speakers. The court acknowledged that Senate Bill 10 discriminated among speakers, but felt that Senate Bill 10 was an exercise of valid time, place, and manner restrictions. This is an area that is undergoing quite a bit of attention right now in the courts. And so those are basically the case. Those are the main issues in the case. Our brief was filed with the court on March 27th. We have requested zero extensions. The state's brief is due June 10. We anticipate the state will ask for a variety of extensions. Senate Bill 577 will allow us to bypass the Court of Appeals and place this matter squarely before the Supreme Court. It's going to be there anyway. It will expedite the court's review by advancing this case ahead of the rest of the civil docket. And because the case cannot be settled and will ultimately be in the Supreme Court, we believe that the bill will save all parties significant time, possibly years, and cost and expense, and conserve judicial resources. And we commend the bill to you, and we ask for your favorable consideration. That's it. And if you have any questions, please answer them.
Just for the record, I like to ask questions that I already know the answers to, but the record is already complete with regard to what can be appealed at either level. So we're ready to move whether it goes to the appeals court or whether it goes to the Supreme Court. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the case was tried on what are called cross motions for summary judgment, and so all the facts were agreed to, and the case is fully developed. It just needs a resolution with respect to what is the law and how should the law be applied to those facts.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have no one else on the witness list. Is there anyone here who would like to speak to this bill? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 577, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 577. Do you want to make this?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 577 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 577 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? My comment is I do feel, having worked on both Senate Bill 10 and then this year's Senate Bill 30, that resolution is important for us to move on and do things that we need to do. And so from my perspective, this is a good thing to get going. It lets the public and everybody else find the conclusion to this, and then we can work from there. So that's my purpose for having the bill here now. Yes, Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I understand that and support this effort, but it is hard for me not to be mindful that every request for justice is urgent.
Yes.
And if there's no value that the Court of Appeals provides, why do we subject any cases to it?
I agree. I understand that.
There's a little bit of iron here.
Thanks. Any other comments, discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote. Thanks.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye. Motion passes. Is there anyone who would like to carry this? If not, I will. But if there is anyone else that is dying to do
it, I'll carry it, Mr.
Representative Girard will carry the bill. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close our work session on Senate Bill 577. Senate Bill 916.
I'm
going
to go back to
16A. I need my Gelser for that one, so I was hoping she'd get here. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 916A. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 916A requires county budgets to contain a summary of revenues and expenditures for specified major programs funded in part by state resources. It specifies that this summary must include revenues and expenditures in the adopted budget, previous year's budget, and actual revenue and expenditure data from the previous 2 years. Reduces the amount of time for which county governing body may change the fee from 1 year to 6 months. Allows local governments to publish annual budget summaries by program instead of by fund or organizational unit. permits mailing to each post office box and rural route number belonging to a resident who to serve as publication under local budgeting law. The Association of Oregon Counties put forward Senate Bill 916A to provide for uniform collection of county financial summary data information in order to further the work of counties in presenting their budgets to the Legislative Assembly.
Very good. So we will have Commissioner Janet Carlson, Ralph Wyatt, and Kara Fisher.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner, and I'm pleased to be before you today on support of Senate Bill 916A. Since January of this year, I have been co-chairing the Governance Committee of the Association of Oregon Counties, and one of our affiliate groups includes the county administrators. You may recall John Latimer, who's our county administrator, who was once the legislative fiscal officer of this body, and so he's very aware of budgets. He's our budget officer. And he makes noises every now and then about how archaic and cumbersome some of the aspects of local budget law are. And at his request, and Ralph Wyatt is here, John Krosick, several of the county administrators went through the local budget law and proposed a number of changes to it. At the urging of the Governance Committee, the bill was drafted. Linda Madrell is our president this year from AOC. She's from Benton County, and Senator Morse graciously agreed to draft the bill for us. The bill was moving forward nicely, and then we learned that there were some concerns about some of those provisions from the special districts and from the Department of Revenue and from the League of Cities. And so we worked diligently, had a meeting, and we pared down the bill with agreement from those bodies that the Department of Revenue would pull us together over the interim and work on the more difficult areas. So what you see before you is really the low-hanging fruit. Everyone has agreed to this, to these provisions. John Phillips from the Department of Revenue was very helpful in our meeting, and he was at the Senate committee meeting to testify in favor of the bill, and we are looking forward to the interim work. I've provided two handouts for you just to give you a sense of kind of what my interest is in this. Senate Bill 5520, which came out of, I think it was two sessions ago as a budget note, when Congressman Schrader was then Senator Schrader and was involved in the Ways and Means Committee. And we worked together with the Legislative Fiscal Office to try to ascertain how much funds that programs that the state funds, those shared services, you've all seen that chart that AOC carries around, how much money do the counties put in these different areas, and where do all of the revenues come from, and how do we really support those services financially. So this color handout that I have shows you those charts. Those charts came about, and they look really simple, but they came about because of this big, thick document, which I provided to you in black and white, called Making History One Survey at a Time, where we all had to, as counties, well, it took us about 3-4 months to actually get the survey together, all agree on it, then get it out, a few more months for people to get it back in, to get apples and apples as we were trying to compare numbers and figure out how all of this budget information fit together. It was not an easy process, and we're very excited that Senate Bill 916 actually provides for a uniform system for counties to submit this information so we don't have to go through quite the same level of cumbersomeness in the future. So with that, I will conclude my testimony, and Mr. Wyatt here will take you through the more technical aspects of the bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Ralph Wyatt. I'm the Linn County Administrative Officer, and among other things, I'm the Budget Director for the county. As Commissioner Carlson has stated, basically this is low-hanging fruit. The real direction that we're trying to do is provide a little more flexibility, a little more capability for municipal governments to operate their organization. Commissioner Carlson talked about 5520. The other things were mentioned by Mr. Watson. It allows a fee change every 6 months. My comment there is a lot of state laws set fees for counties. We in Linn County adopt our fee ordinance in late June for the next fiscal year. State laws become effective, a lot of them, 1 January. So we're kind of automatically 6 months out of step. This would allow us to make changes at that occurrence instead of every 12 months. the post office box change, rural route number change, was really a request from Department of Revenue. They would like to see that happened. It's included. There's increased flexibility to transfer between funds. Right now, it's a one-way from the general fund out, not the other direction. The interfund loan capability. A few years ago, you had to repay an interfund loan within that fiscal year. Then it was changed so you could borrow if you had the capability to do that internally for 5 years. This would extend that to 10 years. An example, we have a road fund that's going on $40 million. We borrow from that to fund things like buying new software system. This would allow us to repay that over a little longer period of time. It changes the definition having to do with supplemental budgets to a reasonable person standard. If you are going through the process the way the law reads right now, you literally have to foresee that you're going to have a supplemental budget to justify having a supplemental budget. So this modifies that somewhat. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but from a local government county perspective, these changes kind of take off a few of the sharp edges and allow us a little more flexibility in operating. And as you know, as well as I do, in this time economically with revenues, and we get a lot of money from the state, so we're very interested in what happened upstairs today with the co-chair's budget, but would ask your support for this. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Kara Fisher. I'm Deputy Director of the Association of Oregon Counties. Commissioner Carlson and Mr. Wyatt have given you most of the background on the bill. In the interest of time, I would only add that the League of Oregon Cities supports the bill and has submitted a letter to you today for the record of its support. Also, as Commissioner Carlson said, during the process while we were looking for amendments for the bill, the Department of Revenue, League of Oregon Cities, and the Special Services District, along with AOC, determined that working together during the interim to look at updating or offering suggestions on how to make local budget law more effective, more cost-effective, and easier for our constituents to understand. So I think that you'll see us back next session bringing to you ways that local governments can be more efficient and effective with local budget. And we are ready for questions if you have any.
Any questions for this group? I guess mine, this has been an interesting area in general, the shared responsibilities. And I've asked for two documents from our legal counsel in the state over the last couple months, asking them to outline what are the legal responsibilities in that field. I think you've probably seen some of those. And it's interesting, you know, you have to keep asking more questions to get to the answer at the bottom of the, well, what are those responsibilities? And so I appreciate all the work people are doing to start outlining those, because it's going to be very important in the next few years as we go through this. And then when the county payments money ends, all of those things, if we don't truly understand both sides what those are, I think we're in a world of hurt. And this starts at getting to some of that and giving people the opportunity to do things. So I appreciate it coming forward and that you work to get something that everybody can agree with, because getting to the points where they don't agree right now, we've got a lot of work left to do on that one. Representative Berger.
Yeah, I just want to thank these folks for coming forward with this and working so hard. Anticipating the next step, I would say all this needs to be posted on the web, too. And it's not in here, but that's the direction we're going, clearly. And so eventually it's all going to be linked so that a citizen can go on the web and find this information under a whole host of. So just in anticipation of the next thing.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, if I could just respond to that. Part of the area that we had sought to change in the what was probably too expansive a move initially was to allow counties the opportunity to portray their budgets by program. And as you know, you all portray your budget at the state level by program. Counties in those shared services are still required to portray their budgets by fund. And so, for example, the sheriff has five or six different funds, and it's difficult for the constituent to be able to look at that budget and really understand, so how much money goes for the jail, how much money goes for enforcement officers, how much money goes for the traffic team. The health department has all of theirs in one fund, so you can't tell how much money is for mental health, how much money is for public health, how much money is for developmental disabilities. So that's the work that we were trying to get at. For very small jurisdictions, particularly special districts and small cities, they're very happy doing their budgets by fund, and they weren't really interested in trying to move to some other system. So we're going to have to sort out over the interim how we might be able to make our budgets at the county level transparent for the public, and at the same time allow the Department of Revenue the apples and apples information that they need to be able to compare dollars and allow the small jurisdictions the stability that they desire. So that's just kind of a preview of what's to come.
Representative Gray.
Just a quick question. How many varieties of a budget do you get from the 36 counties?
I'm tempted to say 36.
I figured that was the answer, right, to be honest with you.
But John Krausig, who worked on this bill, who is, now John semi-retired, he's a budget officer for Yamhill County, but was the administrative officer for years and is into this, has been collecting audits and budgets from counties for probably at least 10 years that I know of. And the real difficulty is sorting it out and getting apples to apples, because a lot of times some folks have moved much more to programs than others. So it's really difficult. And having been in the budget business at county level for 17 plus years now, and we've gone around, actually from Linn County, gone around to other counties and looked at how they do their budgets. And I think we visited eight counties in the Willamette Valley, and there were eight different structures, literally. I mean, if you really took it apart, it was the same function, but you really had to take it apart.
One final comment.
Follow up. Yeah,
just that it's nice to see Commissioner Carlson. We served together in our first terms here in the House, and it's nice to see you and continue the great job you're doing as a commissioner.
Thank you.
So any other questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here. And we're going to close our public hearing. Thank you. On, where are we at? Senate Bill 916A. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 916A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 916A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 916A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roland?
Aye. Motion passes. And you asked a lot of questions about this bill. Do you want to carry a couple bills, Representative Correa?
If the chair wishes, I shall.
Nobody knows county budget.
Representative Garrard will carry this bill. I appreciate that. So we're going to close our work session on Senate Bill 916A, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 61A, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roebling, members of the committee. Senate Bill 61A adds the Deputy Commissioner of Labor, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction to the list of public officials exempt from lobbyist registration and a reporting requirement. A series of statutes regulating lobby activities in the Oregon Legislature, ORS 171.725 to 171.785. These lobby regulations apply generally to public agency officials' conduct when they lobby for their agencies. However, certain statewide public officers, officials, and their staffs do not have to register as lobbyists and file statement of expenditure. For example, the Deputy Secretary of State and Deputy Attorney General are exempt from registration and filing.
So, with that, we invite Kate Newhall.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm the Legislative and Communications Director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And again, I think Jerry pretty much took all my testimony right away from me. But I'll repeat some of it again here. I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify in support today of Senate Bill 61, which would correct what we believe to be an oversight in ORS 171.735, which is the list of public officials exempt from lobbyist registration and filing requirements. Boley's deputy commissioner oversees our agency operations, supervises staff, and handles a number of administrative functions within our office. The deputy commissioner does not engage in lobbying, as defined in ORS 171.725, except that he sometimes is involved in agency responses to elected officials on issues that relate to legislation. As you all know, Oregon law requires lobbyists to register with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission and to file quarterly expenditure reports. And generally, people exceeding the thresholds of 24 hours lobbying in a quarter or $100 in expenditures are required to register as lobbyists. During the calendar quarter surrounding the legislative session, our deputy, who doesn't regularly engage in lobbying, sometimes exceeds that 24-hour standard in the time he spends responding to legislative issues. Unlike other statewide officials' deputies, the deputy commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries has no permanent exemption and is required to register as a lobbyist and file quarterly lobbying expenditure reports. As a state agency, Boley doesn't have any funds with which to lobby the legislature, and the expenditure reports that we all file, Boley also has two registered lobbyists, myself and Bob Estabrook, reflect zero expenditures each quarter. For the negligible amount of time that the deputy spends responding to legislators, which often gets caught up in this definition of lobbying, maintaining a current registration and submitting reports every quarter seems unnecessary, especially given that the Deputy Labor Commissioner doesn't actively engage in lobbying and doesn't ever expend any money lobbying.
Senate Bill 61A adds
both the Deputy Commissioner of Boley and the Deputy Superintendent of Instruction to the exemption list in ORS 171.735. The exemption we're seeking is not unique, and it's not new. It is the same exemption provided to the majority of deputy-level officials, as well as five sub-deputy officials in the offices of statewide electeds. Also, it's important to note that this exemption applies only to the requirement to register as a lobbyist and to file expenditure reports, it doesn't apply to any of the other lobbying regulations found in 171.725. It only exempts the deputy and the deputy superintendent from the requirements to register and to file expenditure reports. Let's see, and I'm just not going to say the rest of my testimony here. And in closing, we urge you to support Senate Bill 61 and creating parity between all of the deputy officials of deputies in statewide elected offices. Thank you so much for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions for this witness? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair. I just have one question. And why is it that this group of legislators would want to take on, in the body of things, two more lobbyists?
I don't think you may not want to and you may not need to. Help us out.
Okay. Any further questions of this witness? Nope. Then thank you very much, and we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 61A. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 61A. So, yes.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 61A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 61A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. And with that, any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye. Motion passes. This is one of those bills that I think I'll carry just because there may be some questions, and I look forward to that. So we're going to close our work session on Senate Bill 61A, and I would entertain a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Edwards and Representative Gelser to vote on some past bills, if that would be so requested.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the agenda, and I don't know which ones they miss.
Let's see.
But I move the rules be suspended, and Representative Gelser and Representative Edwards be allowed to vote on...
Edwards, it's HJR 7A.
Let me amend my motion. Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended and Representative Edwards be allowed to vote on...
HJR 7.
HJR 7A.
A. Representative Berger moves that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Edwards to vote on HJR 7A. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Edwards, how do you vote?
Aye.
Average votes aye. That one's done. We'll close
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended and Representative Gelser be allowed to vote on
HDR 7A.
HDR 54.
SB 5.
SB 577
and
SB
916. Representative Berger moves that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Gelser to vote on HGR 7A, HGR 54, Senate Bill 577, and Senate Bill 916A. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Representative Gelser, how do you vote?
I vote yes on all of them. Can I?
She votes yes on all four of those bills. So noted. Thank you all. And now, there's no other business to come before our committee for today. So I appreciate all the work of everyone. And with that, we're going to close our rules meeting. We got in 15 minutes early.
15 minutes early.